John Ruskin in The Primacy of Vision, thousands can think for one who can see. Paul, we're delighted to see you. Let's welcome him in the usual way. I should have said that Paul will speak for about 45 minutes, we'll have a short break, but then flow pretty quickly into questions. Again, 45 minutes and finishing at 9:30.
Well, good evening again. Good evening. I'm delighted to be here, and I really appreciate you turning out on an evening like this. This is a fearsome topic. John Ruskin is a fearsome topic. I've tried teaching him before, and I've never succeeded. The man will not stay in his box. He was a polymath, a Victorian, for those of you who haven't come across him before, who lived between 1819 and 1900. And the complete edition of his works, published after his death, runs to 39 very full volumes, which probably constitute about half what he actually wrote. And on top of that, he said a lot. He said of himself at the age of 13, he was always writing to his devoted father. I rather like this. So he's 13 when he writes this. I roll on like a ball, with this exception, that contrary to the usual laws of motion, I have no friction to contend with in my mind, and of course, have some difficulty in stopping. I have some difficulty in stopping as well. I don't know if I'll get to the end of this in 45 minutes. Now, I overheard one or two people coming in and wondering about this quotation and the claims that it's making. The greatest thing a human soul ever does. This is Ruskin. By the way, when you teach him, he tends to take possession of you. It's very difficult to keep away from him. His rhetoric is so powerful. In this world is to see something and tell what it saw in a plain way. Hundreds of people can talk for one who can think, but thousands can think for one who can see. To see clearly is poetry, prophecy, and religion all in one. Now the title of the talk was Thousands Can Think for One Who Can See. You can see that the full quotation makes seeing even more exceptional. By my counting, one can see for 100,000 people who can't. Well, of course, he's hyperbolic. This is how he tends to write. But even though his writing is exceptionally contradictory, and he described his own reasoning as polygonal, that he liked to see a problem from every angle, and when he gave the inaugural address at the Cambridge School of Art in 1858, he said, I'm not satisfied until I've contradicted myself three or four times. So his writing is very, very difficult, as I say, to contain. But running through it is this absolute insistence that it is our duty, our Christian duty. Somebody actually said to me, is this about, has this got a theological angle to it? Oh, yes, it has. His argument, and I'm going to try and reiterate it, is that it is the absolute Christian duty, the absolute Christian duty, to see. Now, I'm going to try in this little talk to follow through his arguments. There isn't one place, by the way, where he sets them out very clearly, so I've tried to delve in his writing and pull them out and show you how he thinks we should see. Of course, he saw himself as the prime seer. He used himself as a model. He was, in a way, a Victorian sage, an oracle. He was exemplary. He tried to demonstrate his ideas through his own activities. And he is a teacher. So his writings were always addressed to as wide an audience as he can attempt to reach. So, let me just try and see if I can use my little device. There we are. Now, I'm going to act like a pantomime dame, showing you text on the screen. I wouldn't sing, but it's a peculiar way to act. But I don't want to try to ventriloquize or paraphrase our authors. I want to show you what they're saying. And when Ruskin insists that sight is the greatest gift, certainly the greatest sensory gift that we possess as created human beings, he is actually speaking in a long tradition. You can trace it back to Aristotle if you want, but in more recent times, Da Vinci, as many of you know, is very eloquent in his own notebooks about these propositions. So just let's see what Da Vinci says. The eye, the window of the soul, is the chief means whereby the understanding may most fully and abundantly appreciate the infinite works of nature. The eye. Why? Because it counsels and corrects all the arts of mankind. It has measured the distances and sizes of the stars. It has discovered the elements and their location. What an organ. It can look at the heavens and it can look at a grain of salt. In an instant, it can contain the universe. Oh, excellent thing, superior to all others created by God. The art of painting, very important this, includes in its domain all visible things. Now, clearly Da Vinci is making an argument on behalf of painting as a rhetorical practice, as against other arts. And here are Da Vinci's drawings. So when Ruskin says sight is preeminent, he's following in a tradition which, if we have more time, we could trace more fully. And how does Ruskin believe we should use our sight? Well, he says it is not, it sounds very familiar this to us, it's almost like the introduction to a rambling association guide. It is not possible for a Christian man to walk across so much of a root of the natural earth with mind unagitated and rightly poised, without receiving strength and hope from some stone, flower, leaf, or sound, nor without a sense of a dew falling upon him from the sky. Priests tell us often to meditate in the closet, but they send us not like Isaac into the fields at evening, it means eventide. He was brought up as an evangelical, by the way, and his early career is very anti-papist, so the priests there are probably Catholic priests. His sentiments, by the way, are very close at this time, this is 1846, to the Tractarians. You find in the writings of Newman and Pusey very similar sentiments about the humility that's required to walk the lanes and the fields and to have due regard for every element of God's creation. And one of Ruskin's favourite artists is William Hunt. This isn't William Hopeman Hunt, by the way, those of you who know about painting. This is a different one. A watercolourist, whose very particular and precise use of watercolour and body colour in a sort of pointillist way, using little tiny dots, the beautiful examples in the Fitzwilliam Museum, enabled him to create these fascinating and complete visual accounts, descriptions, if you want, of the overlook, the primroses, the mosses, the nests, the eggs, and so on. Ruskin exulted in this sort of art. In Modern Painters, his great five-volume work, he says, go to nature, you painters, go to nature in all singleness of heart, rejecting nothing, selecting nothing, and scorning nothing. Go out there and look at these things. How dare you overlook a single blade of God's own glass? And this accounts for the sort of exact scrutiny that you see in a picture like this. And for Ruskin, it's our duty to follow the example of Holman Hunt. And if I can just give you some examples here, Ruskin in his writings is constantly scolding his readers, saying, you simply don't look. And one of the delights of reading Ruskin is to follow his own vision. He says, go out What do you think the lawn of grass in your garden is coloured in the sunlight? Green? No, it isn't. It's yellow. You've never looked at it, have you? Here's a quotation. What you thought was bright blue, he says. You think that such a thing is bright blue, say the seat of this chair, is when you look close only dusty grey or green or purple, or every colour in the world at once, only a single gleam or streak of pure colour in the centre of it. Have you ever noticed that? He says, no shadow can be predicted from the form of the object which casts it. Have you ever noticed that? I thought that was very enlightening. You think you can predict the shadow from the form. If you know the form, you can, but you can't. He's noticed that. We haven't. No shadow is generally darker than the dark side of the object which casts it. The reflection of a black gondola in Venice is never black, but pure dark green. He constantly goes around. This from his diary of 1846. He's constantly keeping a diary. He's in the Swiss Alps. And he writes to himself, note the intense scarlety purple of the shattered larch stems, wet, opposed with yellow, from decomposing turpentine. The older stems looking much like birch, covered with white, branchy moss, that looks like coral. So we seem to follow Ruskin around, searching the world, the natural world, for extraordinary images, constantly. And obviously, in a way, this helps explain why he is such a vigorous defender of the Pre-Raphaelites. This is Holman Hunt's original, The Light of the World in Keble College. There are other versions. You may have seen one in St. Paul's. That's much later, by the way, St. Paul's Cathedral. It wasn't even painted by Holman. And there's a little one in Manchester, not painted, but this is the original one. And Ruskin is especially keen to defend this sort of close painting. Holman Hunt, by the way, spent the moonlit nights of a cold November and December sitting in a wood outside a farm in Surrey, his legs covered in straw, attempting to capture moonlight and the appearance of ivy through the night, painting between 9 p.m. and 5 a.m. every night. Such was his devotion to this truth of vision itself. And Ruskin applauds this. By the way, of course, let's remember this. That what Ruskin is doing is applauding a picture like this, he writes vigorous letters to the Times, is defending a form of art which evangelicals found very difficult to swallow, because is not this a picture in breach of the second commandment? I'll come back to Ruskin and the Bible just a little later in this talk. Isn't this an idol? And the Bible's attitude to vision itself is something that we'll have to think hard about. I'm not a theologian, so I'm looking for guidance from you. Ruskin himself believed that to help direct our vision of this marvelous world which we've been given, then the practice of drawing and painting is an obligation not of just of artists, but of each of us. And he showed by his own example what that meant. So there is a Ruskin drawing, study of a sprig of myrtle. He'll often do this, using watercolour particularly, and pencil, make studies almost as a sort of daily habit of the things that he finds in the world. And here is something else. I said, what does he expect our vision to be like? Well, close scrutiny of things, certainly. But look at this. Remember that when the imagination and feelings are strongly excited, they will look into minute things with a delight quite unknown in hours of tranquility. Things trivial at other times assume a dignity or significance which we cannot explain, but which is only the more attractive because inexplicable. The powers of attention, now this is the very important bit, quickened by the feverish excitement, fascinant, feed upon the minutest circumstances of detail and remotest traces of intention. Now, he's arguing here that when we look not only with our eyes, but we look with our, now this is a very romantic idea, with our heart. Because for me, the key word in all of this, whoops, I've done it again. Where's it come? Let's go now. The key word is there. He is a child of romanticism. He read Coleridge and Wordsworth enthusiastically. He also read Shelley, by the way. And he believes that if we are to see truly, we see with our heart. Now, the great fear of the Romantics is that the heart will become an uncontrolled organ of sensibility. It will emote. It will simply erupt. And Ruskin is always guarding against that. He says, you cultivate your heart, the throbbing organ of love. He says, you must see with love that is generated out of the heart. But that love must be trained, it must be directed, it must in some ways be, well, not controlled. But as you see, its feverish excitement must fasten on something. It must improve our vision itself. So we must not just see with the eyes, we must see with the heart. And then he makes another suggestion, that in our vision, we must have an understanding of the relationships between things. What he called the law of help. Each individual organism has a generative function, a purposiveness through which it grows. But organisms in environments relate one to another. And we must have a sympathy for their place, their location, the way they relate one to another. So he says, for instance, I'm going to read this out now. He says, the botanist counts the stamens and affixes a name and its content. But the artist observes every character of the plant's colour and form, considering each of its attributes as an element of expression. He seizes on its lines of grace or energy, rigidity or repose, notes the feebleness or the vigour, the serenity or the tremulousness of the hues, observes its local habits, its love or fear of peculiar places, its nourishment or destruction by particular influences. He associates it in his mind with all the features of the situations it inhabits and the ministering angel agencies necessary to its support. Sounds a bit like ecology. He is a visionary. But notice that he says to see is not simply to fix our attention myopically on one thing. We must understand how one thing relates to another. This is our, for him, our Christian duty. And in his own drawings, these two drawings are by Ruskin. This one mostly completed in one day on his momentous and rather tragic holiday in Scotland with Millais and Ruskin's wife. That's another story altogether. You'll see how, by the way, he tries to understand in this drawing the way things relate one to another. A sort of current runs through the rock. These things aren't inert, they're vitalized. He called this the principle of vital beauty. You must be able to see in the world the way in which somehow energy courses through it. Now, by the way, this refined vision that he is exhorting us to practice was of course part of the way of seeing of the time. He lives in an age of great scientists. Darwin was an acquaintance of his. You read The Voyage of the Beagle, and what does Darwin do as he circumnavigates the world? He uses his eyes to record everything, by the way, not just botany, but anthropology and geology. Anything that he sees, ornithology, it all goes down there. Thomas Herschel, in the 1830s, Charles Lyell, these are great observers, and Ruskin takes his place amongst them, all using their eyes, trying to keep their minds fresh from conventions and prejudices and preconceptions, and to see things as freshly as they can. And it's actually Ruskin who coins the phrase the innocent eye, the childlike vision. But, and you can see how exacting this notion of vision is, if we're going to practice this, we must be able to see with this innocence and freshness, we must see with our hearts, but also we must have imagination. Now, what is imagination? In the 18th century, when aesthetics as a discipline develops, it's really this question of the imagination that concerns the greatest writers. Principally, Kant. How does the imagination work? They're thrilled and puzzled by this ability of the mind to encompass so much so rapidly. But nobody captures this strange capacity of being human more vividly than Ruskin. Just look at this. He's talking about the great minds, the great poets and artists, who he believes have this capacity to its greatest, though we all have it. Imagine all that any of these men had seen or heard in the whole course of their lives, laid up accurately in their memories, as in vast storehouses, extending with a poet's even in the slightest intonation of syllables, heard in the beginning of their lives, and with the painters down to minute folds of drapery and shapes of leaves or stones, and over all this unindexed and immeasurable mass of treasure in their memories, the imagination brooding and wandering, but dream gifted, so as to summon at any moment exactly such groups of ideas as shall justly fit each other. This I conceive to be the real nature of the imaginative. So these artists have this store. They can vividly recall things in a way we can't, but we can practice that to an extent. And if we do, we will see more clearly. So there is the imagination in all of this. And Ruskin says it's easily fatigued, this imagination. And the great artists have it. Now, much of Ruskin's writing is devoted to defending Turner, who he knew very well, his family, that's Ruskin's family. His father, by the way, was a sherry merchant. Those of you who have drunk Domecq sherry have been sharing part of the Ruskin history, because his father was the English importer. And sometimes people think it's very strange that Ruskin should support Turner, because Turner's some of the vaporous, almost vapid, you know, strange, abstracted works seem a world away from those studies of primroses and pieces of grass and so on. Well, once you've read Ruskin on imagination, you understand what he was getting at. He believed that Turner was a great artist because he studied the primroses and the birds' nests and the hedgerows and the fields and the trees and so on. But in the vast storehouse of his imagination, he was able somehow to transmute all of this into great visions of the world, which had a truth all of their own. And so the lack of definition in the world, which seems in this picture, which seems very un-Ruskinian, is actually absolutely consistent with his notions of the imaginative capacity and the way in which our vision can be used to communicate that. Now, at the very beginning of this talk, remember, we have that quotation, which I'll just find again if I can. The greatest thing a human soul ever does in this world is to see something. But there's a coda to that, remember. He says, and tell what it saw in a plain way. So for Ruskin, it's not enough for us to see. We must be able to communicate what we see. You can't wander the world in some sort of solipsistic, self-enclosed, self-serving way. You must see things and tell others about them. And to do that, he thought you needed memory and you needed language. So for Ruskin, seeing and speaking are inextricably linked. And I'm going to read you now the last words which he ever wrote. It's good when quite mad. He started going mad in the middle of his life, in the last 15 years of his life. He was almost incommunicado. But he published his great autobiography, Praeterita, it's published in 1889. In the mid-1880s, he wrote the very last words that were ever published. And these words are really an act of memory and vision. So what he writes is this. And remember, his mind is almost completely gone. Fonte Branda. It's a fountain in Siena. That's it. I last saw with Charles Norton under the same arches where Dante saw it. We drank of it together and walked together that evening on the hills above where the fireflies among the scented thickets shone fitfully in the still, undarkened air. How they shone. Moving like fine broken starlight through purple leaves. How they shone. Through the sunset that faded into the thunderous night, as I entered Siena 3 days before, the white edges of the mountainous clouds still lighted from the west, and the openly golden sky calm behind the gate of Siena's heart, with its still golden words, Cor magis tibi sena pandit, and fireflies everywhere in the sky, and cloud rising and falling mixed with the lightning and more intense than the stars. And then he put down his pen, never wrote again. Now, it's an act not only of vision, that, but of imagination and crucially of memory, and of language itself. You cannot see without language. And he was the child of Romanticism. He writes with the poetry of the great poets. Not only Coleridge and Wordsworth, but Milton. The King James Bible. You can hear the echoes of it now. And I'll move on quickly from this. He's very preachy. If in our moments of utter idleness and insipidity we turn to the sky as a last resource, which of its phenomena do we speak of? One says it's been wet, another it's been windy, another it's been warm. That's about the most we can do, because we can't use language and we can't see. Who among the whole chattering crowd can tell me of the forms and precipices of the chain of tall white mountains that girded the horizon at noon yesterday? None of you. He's going like this. And one of his critics says, it's like being preached at by a mad governess. And it can be insufferable at times, this sort of thing. And yet, he sort of occupies a corner of the conscience, I suppose. And he sees it as his Christian duty. Now he has a great crisis of faith in the middle of his life, and for a time he's a sort of deist. But in his early years, he is a very fervent evangelical. And he sees it as his job to bring to life, to our attention, the inexhaustible loveliness which God has stamped upon all things. It's lovely language, isn't it? The woods which I had only looked on as wilderness fulfilled, I then saw in their beauty the same laws which guided the clouds, divided the light and balanced the waves. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. By the way, there isn't just the Bible in this, there's Plato. He was a great student of Plato. Plato's Timaeus. And Plato's vision of the creation as well, and of a world which at some level has form and order. But we get to the Bible now, and this is where I'm on treacherous territory. I'm no Bible scholar, partly, by the way, because I was brought up a Roman Catholic. And I went to Eamon Duffy's talk in Saffron Walden at St. Mary's on Friday on the King James Bible, and somebody asked him at the end, what do the Catholics think of the King James Bible? Because, by the way, Eamon Duffy was advocating that everybody read the King James, the Anglicans use the King James Bible. So somebody said, rather cheaply said, what do the Catholics think of the King James Bible? And Eamon Duffy said, the Catholics don't read the Bible. Which is true. So my biblical scholarship is virtual, but here is Ruskin anyway, and I won't read it all out. You can see it for yourselves. The way he quotes from the Bible. Here we are. From Isaiah, yea, the fir trees rejoice at thee, the cedars of Lebanon, saying, since thou art gone down to the grave, no fellow is come against us. And then from Matthew. They toil not, neither do they spin. And then Psalm, I think it's 114, the sea, or it's 119, he quotes from both. The sea saw that and fled, Jordan was driven back, the mountains skipped like rats, wonderful, isn't it? And the little hills like lambs. Somebody can rank, oh, is it 103? I get confused with my Psalms. But it's very interesting, though, he has recourse to the Bible. And maybe we can talk about this afterwards, you can help me with it. The Bible actually is very ambivalent about sight, isn't it? I mean, it's a richly poetic evocation of the beauty and the power of the world. Of course it is. But as for vision itself, as for sight, sight can be proud and wanton and lustful. It can be disobedient, it can be punished, it paws, it mocks, the eyes mock and wink, you know, the eyes are terrible things, and when they offend thee, of course, you know what to do with them. And it's almost embedded in the second commandment, of course, the fear of idolatry. And I was interested, you know, I thought I'll go to the Bible. These days you can research the Bible, can't you, very easily, with these wonderful websites that will give you every instance when a word is used. So I thought, what happens when you put in vision, sight, see, looking, what happens? You know? And of course, you know, these are, I don't know, Hebrew or Greek, let alone Latin very well, so using the King James Bible. And I was interested to find that if you want the prime viewer or the great pair of eyes in the Bible, who do they belong to? I'm going to ask you a question now. Well, I'll tell you who they belong to. God. Genesis. The creation story. God is constantly looking at what he sees, and he finds it good. And throughout the Bible, he's looking down on his creation, on his people, and he sees all that they do. He sees. He's constantly seeing. I thought it was really interesting that he sees. And Deuteronomy, the Psalms, obviously. Job is very interesting, chapters 39 to 41. They're quite wonderful when God scolds Job for not appreciating the glory of the world. Though actually, I looked very carefully, and God keeps saying, at least in the King James Version, that Job doesn't know the world properly. It doesn't say you don't see the world properly. And the occasion is actually in the Bible when the Jews are, then eventually I guess the Gentiles, instructed to scrutinize the world in detail in the Ruskinian way. They're almost non-existent. The nearest actually is the Sermon on the Mount. But in the English translation, even it doesn't say behold the lilies of the field. It says consider. You behold the fowls of the air, and you consider the lilies of the field. They are arrayed in greater splendor than Solomon. I say all of this because what Ruskin is doing here in encouraging sight and vision in the 19th century is highly controversial. Certainly amongst the evangelicals, not just a question of their extreme anxiety about image making, but their extreme anxiety about sight itself. Of course, it's the lustful and wanton eye is a part of this, but there is a tradition that comes out of Calvin, and I think it's perfectly just. It's there in the Bible that sees the world as some sort of shadowy place, sometimes illuminated by shafts of light. But we see through a glass darkly, and vision is not to be trusted except when it's the vision of something beyond our world, as well as within it. So I say all of this because Ruskin is weaving through very difficult territory. Now I'll go on from this to make another point, and that is that this vision that we're to have should not only be intense, an ability to see innocently and clearly, to see with our hearts, to see with our souls, to see with Christian belief and understanding. But, and this is his great shift, it should also be socially conscious. So look what he says here. And so completely unexceptionally is this so that if I had time tonight, I could show you that a nation cannot be affected by any vice or weakness without expressing it legibly and forever, either in bad art or want of art, and that there is no national virtue, small or great, which is not manifestly in all the art which circumstances enable the people possessing the virtue to produce. What he's saying here is that our sight actually is conditioned by the society in which we live. He came to this view gradually, but by 1849, 1850, he's come to think that his mission to try to renovate vision in England is probably hopeless, because in that benighted, consumerist, materialist, hypocritical, and, dare I say it, capitalist country. This is what he decides. Vision is so fixated on profit, on the mundane, the trivial, the vulgar, the trite, that unless you reform the society, then nobody can see anything. And he goes on to, how am I doing for that? I must press on from this. He tries to demonstrate, by the way, that this vision of ours, this attention particularly to the glories of nature, should transfer to our making of our own worlds. And in this demonstration, it's from a lecture that he gave in Edinburgh in 1853 to the great and good of Edinburgh. He says that if you're going to make things, then make them according to the principles that you find here. He's making a joke, by the way. This is the ash. He says this is the beauty of things. And here I've drawn you an ash branch according to Greek principles, he says. How do you like that? Do you want one of those? No. Make your world naturally, That's his point. I could elaborate that. You know, it's a very complicated argument. And so he goes, "No," say many of my antagonists, "taste is one thing, morality is another. Tell us what is pretty." I love this. "We shall be glad to know that, but preach no sermons to us." And then he goes on, "The first and last and closest trial question to any living creature is, what do you like? Tell me what you like and I'll tell you what you are." So it's not just about seeing things, it's about the things we have around us that we make because of the things that we see. And so he goes on. I could develop a point, I won't. Well, some of you may know that he sees Venice, the Republic of Venice, extraordinarily, by the way, as a society in which somehow the justice of government, the orderly relations of the society itself, the merit of its workers justly rewarded, provides the conditions for proper and just vision. And
just a little quotation. Here we are.
I won't read you the whole quotation. This is, as you may know, the gables of St. Mark's Basilica, which he thought was the greatest of all buildings. And why? Well, he romanticizes, but he says the medieval workman's habitual tenderness and devotion to subtle inquiry. This is the medieval workman. And every discriminating and delicate touch of the chisel as it rounds the petal and guides the branch is a prophecy of the development of the entire body of the natural sciences. He argues that this is great because those who made it saw clearly and worked freely. That they lived in a society which justly rewarded their efforts and gave them liberty to invent. He says the same of Venetian painting, by the way. I'll just make these are complicated points. Forgive me if I don't develop them. But I just wanted to point out that in Ruskin's notion of the vision we should all cultivate, painting, as well as architecture, has a very high priority. And he develops an argument which is obviously easy to ridicule, easier to refute. He develops an argument that the greatest paintings, the greatest art, the greatest concentrations of vision, if you want, the greatest examples of visual intelligence come from those societies, not just those individuals, those societies which elevated the notion of the dignity of the individual and the community to the highest level. And that these images display a humanity which he believed Victorian art was simply incapable of. It's not simply a matter of technical excellence. It's an ability to see. It's always vision with him, but to see people truly. The great artists of Venice, of Veronese, and Tintoretto, and Titian can see figures truly. And this is the last point I'll make now about Ruskin and vision. And this is the most arduous. He came to believe that if our vision was true, it should not simply rejoice in the beauty of the primrose, but it should look unflinchingly at what is appalling in the sight of vision. It should have the courage to look at ugliness, because that is a Christian duty as well. And so he says, we do not travel for adventures nor for company, but to see with our eyes and to measure with our hearts. If you have sympathy, the aspect of humanity is more true to the depths of it than its words. And even in my own land, the things in which I've been less deceived are those which I've learnt as their spectator. If you're to see your society, don't read about it, don't listen about it, you go and see it. That's what he's saying. You must see it. So he goes and sees. He goes to South London, not the worst place in the world, in his time it seemed to be. He goes to Rochdale, for God's sake. He goes to Bradford. He goes to Sheffield. And he sees with his own eyes. And he, remember, you must see and you must communicate what you see as plainly as you can. And he's outraged by what he sees. Not by what he's read, but what he sees with his own eyes. And he's constantly recording these visions in apocalyptic prose, maybe, but as honestly as he can. So Ruskin has exacting standards of vision. I can't even make a quick inventory of all the things that we're supposed to be doing. God help us. We're supposed to be scrutinizing with this freshness of vision, paying attention to the least things. We're supposed to be seeing with our hearts. We're supposed to be seeing with our souls. We're supposed to be using our memory, our imagination, our knowledge. Didn't mention that, you know. He is a geologist himself and a botanist. We must see honestly. We must have an historical sense. And we must have a social conscience in our vision. We must see things. Now, if we were... This is the finale now. This is where you're going to help me. If we could ectoplasmic... Well, I think he's been here all along. I can never get rid of Ruskin. You know, he's such a strong presence. We can ectoplasmically conjure him now. He would be shaking his head, obviously. And he would look at us and judge us by his standard of what is required of vision itself. And I'm least well equipped to talk about this, and I won't at any length, but I think he would be distressed at the state of our education. He was a great educationalist himself. He believed that drawing should be a compulsory requirement in primary schools. By the way, he was the first advocate of universal free education. And he believed that the very centre of the curriculum should be drawing, not peripheral. He thought drawing was more important, actually, than literacy. And that wasn't what, that was observational drawing. He would be distressed with the state of our art schools, it hardly needs to be said, where drawing has been banished. I don't know how many of you know this, from many courses, particularly fine art courses. I suppose we could try to persuade him that our care for the environment, which he felt passionately about, was one of the advances we have made. And I think he might concede that. He was a great preservationist and conservationist. But I think he would have been justly critical of the fretfulness of modern vision. It's a cliche, obviously, but the we see ourselves as a visual age, our digital imaging. Obviously, the impossibility of arresting vision, which he thought was so important, concentrating on the things seen, when we're constantly distracted by the flood of images. We're all very familiar with this bewildering flood of images. We pride ourselves on our visual sophistication. He would have been contemptuous at our inability really to stop and look. He would have been contemptuous about our commercialism. You know, we have become a spectacular society. After all, our consumer world famously is a world of images, a world of appearances. shopping centres. Clearly he would have regarded this as the basis of materialist form of vision. He would have been appalled by our inability, by the way, to see with a social conscience. As we go through our recession, I guess most of us will travel through a tunnel, not wishing to visually see the consequences of what's happening. We may read about it, but we'll live in our own worlds. And he would have been contentious of that. About belief, by the way, the lack of belief, he came eventually to believe maybe that the loss of that the relationship between true vision and Christian belief is very questionable. He met too many very sincere Christians who couldn't see to persuade him that there was a direct relationship between the two. And just to throw in one of the most interesting thinkers on all of this, of course, recently has been John Polkinghorne from this very university, who has argued that aesthetics has to be factored back into the argument about science and belief. Not just the beauty of mathematics, but the beauty of creation itself. At times he sounds like a Ruskinian, which is interesting too. Well, I think I've overrun a bit, and that's about as far as we can go.
Wonderful. Well, Paul, there's so many fascinating themes and issues and topics we could pick up on. If you have a question, please just raise your hand. People come round. Pete's here with a microphone. Speak clearly, please, and let's continue.
Yes, a question over here.
To what extent would you say the use of the camera had either contributed towards our appreciation of the beauty of nature, or actually acted against it?
Yes, that's a very interesting question, particularly as regards Ruskin.
Yes.
I'm not sure I'm qualified to speak very generally, but Ruskin himself was a photographer. Now, you wouldn't think so, would you? He rather liked cameras, and he also employed professional photographers to photograph buildings, to make meticulous records of buildings in his campaign for conservation. But at the same time, he, in his writings, warned against the use of lenses. He believed that the most authentic form of vision is natural vision unable. He might, of course, allow for spectacles. But he actually explicitly warns against the use of the microscope and the telescope. Now, he was adept with the microscope. he was a scientist. He was a polymath. But he was afraid, I think, principally with the microscope, that we might lose that sense of the connection between things. We might become too myopic. You believe that, you know, as we've seen, that vision somehow should be comprehensive. And I'm quite sure that, I was thinking about this very question actually, because I thought, now, our contemporary vision, I think he would have been amazed. Well, he's here, isn't he? He's amazed that we're now so knowledgeable about so many aspects of our natural world. That is layman. Why? Because the wonders of television, the programs that crowd one upon the other, wonderful programs, astronomy, archaeology, zoology, botany, the Attenborough-style programs, you know, I mean, but he would have been contemptuous of that. Why? Because he would have said, that your vision is displaced. What are you looking at here? He would say. You're looking at a screen. Are you looking at the sky? Does that screen send you into your garden to look at those stars? No. Do you know, the coastal programs that we all watch, you know, do the next day go to the coast and watch the balance of the waves? No, you don't. You're seeing everything at one remove or two removes. And that's what he would say.
It makes me fear for our grandchildren. I'm sure that the vast majority of people in this room actually have grandchildren. We have grandchildren who spend half their time looking at various kinds of screens or talking into various kinds of instruments.
That's true.
And I feel that it would have distressed Ruskin enormously if this kind of thing had been in his time. I feel there's a case for altering things,
yes,
but I don't know how.
Yes, absolutely. But Victorian's distressed him as well, you know. I mean, he was professionally distressed.
Paul, I so appreciate what you give us. In fact, there's a piece that we could go on devouring, consuming for another 24 hours. But the issue that I worry about with Ruskin is kind of what I would summarize as kind of a nostalgia. And you feel like he saw the Black Lake, you know, the dark satanic mules coming, and the primroses disappearing, etc. And could you explain the connection between the neo-Gothic revival? There's an example behind you there in that. Cover for the font. And he was very influential in that, wasn't he? And how do you see this? Because I have such sympathy, and incidentally, as an evangelical, great shame at our forefathers who had this problem with enjoying beauty,
yes,
etc. So at the same time, he's putting too much, it seems to me, onto the visual to sustain it.
Well, yes. I mean, that's a huge question. He visited this church. He didn't like Cambridge, though. He came here as little as he could. He's often called the founder of Anglia Ruskin University. He wasn't. He gave the inaugural address and then took not the slightest bit of interest in it. But that's all, by the way. About this sort of thing. He was a very perverse character. I mean, he was extremely influential in the development of the Gothic revival, of which we see so much. An example just across the road, obviously, George of Scots, St. John's Chapel. But he hated most of what was done in his name. That's typical of Ruskin, you know, because he thought it was just crass and insensitive and coarse. And had none of the, and of course Machine made much of it, without that sort of tenderness of touch and naturalness of vision that he thought was true of original medieval work. I think, you know, he wouldn't have liked this, to be honest. He would have thought this was much too mechanical. He liked the irregularities of things. And that's linked to his notion that these, and it's a very romantic, you know, which historians have poo-pooed, but I don't think it can entirely be disregarded. This idea that the medieval craftsman has a latitude, is given a certain degree of freedom. How else is it that every boss, every detail, every crocket, every finial in the great medieval churches, the screen at Lincoln Cathedral, is different. Every one of them, you look closely, and there is not one which is identical with another. So they are not using templates. He knew this. Ruskin always starts from a vision. So he goes, he looks at these things, he looks at them, and he thinks everything is different here, and everything is. Think of the, those of you who've been to the Chanthouse of Southall Minster, and if you haven't, then go there as soon as you possibly can. Wonderful work of the 1290s. And the abundance, the invention, and the naturalness, and the vision of the carving in that, it just takes on. So he goes to these things, and he thinks, how can this be? These cannot have been, you know, these cannot have been overwhelmed craftsmen. They must have had a degree of freedom. And there seems to be a certain invention. He thought it was a joy in what they were doing. Now, obviously in the mechanical age, the Victorian age, that wasn't going to be possible. And he never answered how this was to be done, how this new world was to be created. But at the very least, his lowest position, if you couldn't free the craftsman to work in handicrafts, that's the arts of craftsmanship, which he gives birth to, by the way, and that succeeds immensely well in Cambridge, the arts and crafts movement. Stories way is arts and crafts, a beautiful place. But if that wasn't achievable, he thought, well, at the very least, you should take as your principles of design the laws, he would call them, that you find in the organic world. So Ruskin's distress at seeing how we are today, here he is again, will be compounded by the sight of Travel Lodge in Cambridge. And he would say that that is an index of, he would go as far as to say, the moral condition of our society. Now you don't know what to do. There's something in that. And he would say one of the problems with Travel, and not just Travel Lodge, but modernist architecture, though actually Pevsner regarded Ruskin as a father of modernism, Ruskin would have been appalled. Because he would say, what is lacking in modern design is naturalism. Where is that sense that what we are doing relates to what's our great gift, which is the universe itself? To so abstract and geometricize, so harden the visual world in this way, it ignores, he would say, the laws of God. And whether you're a believer or not, I think there's something at least in that argument. And hence, by the way, revisionist modernist architecture. I'm not being trying to be foolish. The Gherkin, after all, is an attempt, really, to be honest, to try and reinvent an organicism in architecture. How can we get back to that and still be modernist? It's one of the big problems of architecture over the past 20 years ago. I've got a quotation, by the way, that I got from the Times. If you can just find it, if you just bear with me, that relates to what we're talking about. Some of you may know that Stephen Bailey is a great certainly a very influential commentator on design, and here we are. This is from the Times, Stephen Bailey writing in the Times just about this time last year. And I was so taken by this, I wrote it down. So Stephen Bailey writes, anything that is made betrays the beliefs and preoccupations, the morals and the manners of the people who made it. That's his first sentence in an article in the Times. I looked at that and I thought, you old dog, that's Ruskin. That's pure Ruskinian rhetoric. Then he goes on, this is Stephen Bailey. So it's been melancholy these past 30 years to know that Britain has successively, even systematically, abandoned key industrial technologies. If you make money, you just need the morals of a whore and the manners of a dancing master. And when you design and make things, you restore the essential practical and moral connection between effort and reward. So when I read that, I thought, well, the times are a-changing. Because maybe if there was anything to reassure Ruskin over there, it might be those indications of a change in sentiment. Because
in art, by the way, it's been very interesting in the past 100 years, I would say. In many of the, you know, art is a very complicated subject, but in many areas of art, by two stages, the Ruskinian view has been excoriated. I was trying to find the word. In the early 20th century, a type of formalist aesthetics is dominant. That leads to abstract art. It's a very complex subject, this, but to take the greatest English critic, who in some ways is a successor of Ruskin, Roger Fry, who actually died giving the Slane Lectures here in 1934. He only got to lecture two, but that's fine. Roger Fry partly devoted his life to banishing the morality from Ruskin's theory. Fry kept the vision lit and said, we must keep looking, and that in a sense is what makes us truly human, our ability to look aesthetically. That's Kant, by the way. It's a Kantian idea. But this moral stuff that Ruskin had, put in the theory of vision, let's get rid of it. And then in the second half of the 20th century, the dominant theories aren't formalist. They're, in a sense, conceptualist. They hold to the notion that art is principally about ideas. Meaning comes first and form comes second. And I hope you're following me, you know where that's leading, you know, the conceptualist artists and the young British artists and so on, the Damien Hirst and Tracy Evans and so on. It's a form of conceptualism. And that's anti-Ruskinian as well, because Ruskin said, no, ideas don't come first, form comes first. What you see, form first. That's what art is about. Ideas later. Ideas for books, form for vision. So we've had two great movements which have been anti-Ruskinian. The first half of the century, the second half of the century. Both of them have subsided. So, I think that there is a renewed interest in Ruskin now. He's difficult, he's strange, he's remote, but he is powerful. And, no, I'm not heralding a Ruskinian revival. There's something there that we need to think about hard again.
I find it quite interesting to compare, say, somebody who went to an art college in the middle of the 20th century, who said something like Damien Hirst, because from the point of view when, I can't remember the name of it, the man who's just been doing watercolours, gone back to doing watercolours. Well, I'm trying to think of something I can't. The one who does the So when Hopley goes back and uses watercolour, which he hasn't done very much in years and years and years, he's great. But when Damien Hirst tries to copy Hopley and does watercolour, he fails because he hasn't had the grounding in drawing and so on in the latter part of the 20th century that the mid-20th century people had. And I think that is a very, very crucial point, actually. It shows what has been happening. And then you get Saatchi's on this about return of painting. The sad thing is that even tutors in painting don't know how to paint because they haven't been taught how to paint. They've been taught much more of these ideas, the conceptual rather than the visual. So I've got that out of my system, which is probably quite important to know.
I think that's a very pertinent point. If the revival is in vision and observation is going to take place, who's going to lead it? You know, because we've educated a generation whose practice has been elsewhere. I did hear Catch a program on the radio two or three weeks ago, which included, which was about drawing. Unfortunately, I only heard a few minutes of it, but a lecturer from the Ruskin School of Fine Art and Drawing, which is part of the University of Oxford, which I've got to say has had a reputation for neglecting the drawing bit for many years, was saying that now they're reviving the interest and drawing is coming back into the curriculum. And I thought that was really interesting. But there are lots of people around in the sculpture, obviously. But I'd certainly like to see it in the primary school curriculum I'm hesitating as a discipline, a disciplined form of observational recording. Children like to do it. They see it as a skill.
I'm curious about, I was thinking this as I was thinking of the talk. Someone like Charles Dickens, who was very interested in observation and social consciousness, sort of Dickens, expert at all beyond what anyone else would be, but Dickens seemed to have this interest in sort of the morality of vision and collecting data, but he was a great in people and poor people. The rest also had this sort of social interest.
Ruskin's got a very strong social interest, and in his later life, Ruskin doesn't write very much about art at all. He writes this very peculiar series of letters to the working men of Britain. I'm sure none of the working men of Britain read a single one of them. They cost 10 pence for a start. It's a case of reading his letter or letting the family starve. But anyway, the Fors Clavigera, they call them, very peculiar, they're wonderful. Yeah, he's going quite mad when he's writing them, but he addresses the working people. And though politically he was what he described himself as a Tory of the old school, a sort of crazed Tory of the old school, come on, the adjective was. So he's rather patrician. He loathes the government. He loathed the aristocracy. He loathed what he regarded as the exploitation of the working classes. And he was a sort of sympathetic and philanthropic patrician whose ideas sometimes were quite social. So he wasn't a socialist himself. And he believes that the working class have been exploited, abased, debased, and that it's the responsibility of intellectuals such as himself to open eyes as to what their condition is, and to try to open their eyes as well. So he's very vigorous in that way. By the way, he didn't think much of Dickens. I mean, Ruskin is critical of most things. I was thinking about that. Why? Because the two seem to overlap in some ways. Obviously, the great rhetoricians, they reach out, they're prolific, they see social injustice all around them. They're wonderfully descriptive writers. I think Dickens doesn't get out enough in Ruskin's way of thinking. And I thought, but Dickens novels, when does anybody actually go out into the countryside? Except, miserably. they don't take walks and look at primroses in Dickens' books.
But Dickens novels were really entertainment.
Oh yes. Oh no, exactly. I'm not criticised. I love Dickens. I was just saying Ruskin took a very dim view of them, but he took a dim view of Darwin as well. He said that Darwin didn't have sufficient imagination, which I thought was a bit hard.
What do you have any views on theatre and drama as a means of
Okay.
Yes. Communication.
He's a very peculiar character. He loved the musical. It was his favourite entertainment. You know, and the more raucous, the more vulgar, the more ridiculous and preposterous, the better. Ruskin, you know, he doesn't seem to have enjoyed opera. He went to the opera, but he's always moaning about it. But he's always off in the East End to the latest musical. You wouldn't think it, would you? But he did. No, he had this relish for life. So that's extraordinary, isn't it? No. And his most famous phrase, it's worth quoting here, there is, I love this one, there is no wealth, comes from the Bible, isn't it? There is no wealth but life. There is no wealth but life. Life has to be lived vigorously. So he didn't believe we should be prissy, sort of mincing along the... That's right. The daisy buttercup path, you know, sort of sighing at the sight of the crocuses and the stuff. No, you know, you had to be vigorous in your life. And you had to see everything, relish everything. So he believed in all of that. It's an interesting case. I thought I'd get, by the way, that somebody was sort of being very challenging about what I said about the Bible. I thought, but nobody's actually. I think you're probably being too polite.
I could have a crack at it. I mean, my own reading is that a terrible ailment affected those who did take the Bible seriously from about the middle of the 18th century. Related to the Pietist renewal movement which started in Germany. And this basically led to a kind of a ghettoizing of people, that things which were artistic, cultural, intellectual, these were frowned on as over against the experience of the believer. So you had this being the focus, and you have the Wesleyan revivals through that. And so it is a great sadness that at the time that the Romantics were discovering and expressing just the wonder of nature, where within the Christian worldview, when you look back, I mean, you said about the Old Testament not having enough, and, well, you didn't use those words, but that there's not really a very strong emphasis on vision in the Old Testament. You do have this exaltation of nature. So, you know, the trees are going to clap their hands when Jesus comes back, you know, and all that kind of thing. So, it is seen as the ideal. And there's to be a very great respect. But because of this historical moment when there was a reaction against the intellectual, against the political, the cultural, etc., I think there was a withdrawal from that, and that's what he was sadly running into and quite rightly rejecting. But if you ask the question now, what is the Bible's view of image, of vision? I think it's a very high view, and that Jesus' words just encapsulate the whole thing. Solomon and all his glory was not a great life on the knees. If you have eyes to see, see.
Yes.
And if you have ears to hear, hear. Yes. I mean, Ruskin is singling out vision, eyes. But I think the Bible is just saying, listen, with the whole of your being, you should be aware of what you are. And then it would be in the created order. And I think that's where, sadly, I think Ruskin lost the strength of the theological view which he would raise with. Again, I'm not unsympathetic to why he would have been having problems with it. His mother was much too possessive and so on, and that may have affected it. But the whole of the 19th century was moving away from a clear theological position. But I don't think you can fault the Bible, Paul. That is where
it is.
I hope it didn't come over as a criticism of the Bible itself. I was struck by the way in which vision is used to describe the sight of something. Sorry, the sight of something elevated beyond
revealed.
Well, obviously the writers of the Bible themselves are great visionaries, great describers. I was just struck by the, you know, I was trying to find those occasions when individuals in the Bible are exhorted to look closely at what is around them, and I couldn't find them. I didn't think there was a shift in the Gospels, by the way. So many citations of light and sight and blindness and seeing in the Gospels themselves. It's very striking, that sort of vision. It's very important in the Gospels.
I think that seeing, that you're right, that seeing in the Bible, whether it's Old or New Testament, is always much more than just actually seeing the
it's
and you were saying about the vision. But not only that, but when you were saying, like, this brought up a Victorian evangelical, and they have that whole thing about typology, that you look through one thing to see the truth about something else. So the kind of Christian bit in his aesthetic, in the first part of his life, the Christian bit is about looking through the creation to see that God has created it behind him. Interesting that people keep talking about Solomon, and the one place you do get in the Old Testament where people are exhorted to look at something, look at the outcomes of it, you know, the Proverbs. A lot of people think that, Michael Weaver thinks that, you know, Ruskin saw himself as a kind of Victorian Solomon, a sort of wise person. But it's quite interesting that you were talking about the other side is seeing the injustice. And that strand in the Bible, the prophets, Jesus exhorts you to look at the injustice that's going on around you. I think that's much more amenable to Islam.
Thanks for that. Yes, I've left out so much the typology and analogy in his thinking, you know, is very profound, and he expects other seers to think and see as he does. And, I'm afraid I've given a very partial view of him, but that's very interesting.
Well, just one last comment. On that, the emphasis of the Bible is on the Word, you know, the Word, as ever against the eye and vision, simply because, not because there's anything negative about the eye, primarily, but because if you don't have definition, if you don't have some way to define what is right and what is wrong, then one is in a very great danger and vulnerable. And hence the emphasis on the Word in the Bible. So I think that may set up some of this feeling that actually sight is dangerous.
It's trenchant as it is.
Partly because I think idolatry. And this is where the comments about computers and so on, the image, I think, today does have an element in it, I think, of this wanting to have something you can see and handle, as though against a word which seems, distant and not so concrete, but which is absolutely vital, and hence the emphasis. I was interested by Amy Duffy's comment. Mm-hmm. You know, the Protestants were looking at the word in order to get the right answer, as ever against the Catholic emphasis.
Ruskin's words evoke images.
The writer John brings it together so beautifully. We have the word, he was the word, and we have seen him.
Yes,
for the voice of truth.
Yes.
But you just want to bring them together.
Yes, So many references to light, mm-hmm. light. Yeah. I think seven in the first chapter of John, is it? More? Light.
Ian's got a question. Sorry, a question and sort of comment in a way. I think that Paul was right in talking about the fact that there is a kind of ambiguity in the Bible about vision. And right at the very beginning, he saw the apple and saw that it was good. Was tempted. And in a sense, throughout the Bible, you get the idea that nature is to be seen as something which is God's handiwork, but also there's the warning, nature itself can become the object of of veneration, yes, and become the source of our idolatry. Of course, the pagan religions of the time were fertility religions and nature religions, essentially. So nature is very ambiguous, and vision, therefore, and the vision of nature is ambiguous. And I don't know if Ruskin really kind of warned people about that, that there was a kind of lust to the eye, and not necessarily sexual, but just the whole kind of enjoyment of the present rather than and the creation rather than the creator.
I can't remember him doing that. He follows Coleridge quite closely. Coleridge is very keen on this notion of the joy of the eye. You know, this the enthusiasm, this sense of intuition, almost, that the eye rejoices in what it sees, and that's the typical Ruskinian understanding of vision. So, this restless, wanton, lusting, mocking, winking eye that keeps appearing in the Bible, and there is a wonderful, yes, God, I don't know which book it is in, but there is a warning that, you know, don't look at the stars, don't look at the sky in case you make the sky an idol, there are warnings absolutely in the Bible against being so enthralled by the wonder and beauty of the world that you substitute it for God.
Do you think there was a sense this is because Ruskin was a director of the Romantic movement?
Yes.
In a way, the Romantic movement had a vulnerability, a frailty about it, or just didn't understand what Christians would understand as the fall, as the fact of human nature is. It's perverse, and its vision is going to see things wrong in it.
Yes.
I feel that Ruskin perhaps might not understand that.
Yes, I rather suspect that's the case. I can't remember passages where he warns against the sinfulness of sight. He had a great sense of his own sinfulness.
The last two questions, Mark.
Yes. I'm not a question, mine's always a statement, really. It's all very esoteric and extremely interesting, but I think that first painting you showed, the simplicity of the primrose, the simplicity of a primrose in a hedgerow, something that you see and feel is absolutely beautiful, it's got no notice. And you're talking about stars, and I was thinking of sailing the Atlantic. Following the storm to the calm, the beauty of the stars, the phosphorescence on the sea, at one with the world, peace and beauty, God's in his heaven. I just wanted to say that. I mean, actually, sometimes we're looking almost beyond, and actually, the natural thing to write down the sentence is the simple things. I hope you don't mind saying that.
Ruskin. As many of the Romantics did, wondered about how it can be. Actually, John Polkin wonders how it can be that both the world is so beautiful and that we have the capacity to see its beauty and to feel its beauty. Now, that simple puzzle, how can this be? How can this be? Now, recently evolutionary biologists and psychologists like Ramachandran have tried to argue that this aesthetic sense, what you felt in the Atlantic when you saw the stars, is simply a consequence of our early evolutionary needs. And he's developed a whole aesthetic, an evolutionary biological aesthetic, which seems to me not to explain an experience. What possible evolutionary biological need could you be fulfilling in the middle of the Atlantic admiring those stars? I don't know. It seems a mystery to me how this world is so beautiful and how we have this capacity
as Ruskin says, in our eyes, in our reason, in our hearts, and in our souls, in those ecstatic moments to respond to it. It doesn't serve any practical evolutionary function.
May I go back to what Ian was saying just now about romanticism, and in view of the idea that romanticism broke back in European thought, I wonder if you've got any idea how much that actually connects with the evolution of Ruskin's manners. You know, when you're dealing with people like Baudelaire and so on, whether you feel there's any connection between the ideas in romanticism and his madness, because Turner had a similar sort of strange movement in his life as well, didn't he?
I'm not sure I'm qualified to. His madness was such a strange. I mean, he carries with this enormous, fertile, brilliant, and anxious intellect that I think from very early on it's on the edge of. His mind is so capacious and so restless.
Can we move to
that? That doesn't seem to be so surprising.
Yeah, I was thinking more in relationship to what you brought up, and then the point you brought up about this mystery at the heart seems to me to be the last piece in the puzzle that Ruskin was looking for, which is explained actually biblically by a philosophy that we are created in the image of God.
Yeah.
So that is the totally, that's the opposite of this evolutionary search for some sort of animalistic explanation. Art, in a way, is the apologetic, surely, for Christianity, biblical Judaism, Christianity, and that is we are neither mechanical. And it would also, I think it ties with this tension that Ruskin, we were expressing, and I don't know that much about it, but I have seen his arts and crafts work, for instance, in the Lake District, in a way he was searching for something very human. And what is human in all of these things? And it's creating space to love this nature, but to reflect the nature of God. And so God was a creator, and we're supposed to enjoy his creation, but also be able to create and to have non-mechanical, as it turned out, thousands of plastic relatives or something, but have that wonderful touch. So we see a piece of embroidery or his drawing of a rock. And then that takes time, of course, and it's an attitude, a habit. So you can see, following Ruskin in the Lake District was Charlotte Mason, and people like Beatrix Potter, and her great studies of the fungi, etc. And he was appreciated and understood, and there you see children who go out and collect something. So it did belong to something, but sadly, I do think that the unifying principle has to be the thing that all of these, that the social conscience he was looking for, the humanity. I don't know, I'd be very interested to know what he wrote about literature.
I don't know. I'm not going to attempt to answer that. I think what you said is so beautifully expressed, and so pertinent, and so thoughtful, and so actually mysterious. Might serve as the final word.
Thank you.
I think that was a very well said final word, Susan. And I think you've taken us on a journey tonight that really inspires us. And I'm sure we'll all go away from here looking with new eyes.
Thank you, Martin.
Thank you.